Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.
Hello and welcome to the Astronomy Show right here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. I'm John Dixon and you can also catch us live on the internet at dublincityfm.ie or on www.astronomy.ie or as a podcast. And of course, a very special welcome to if you're joining us on astronomy.fm across the Atlantic Ocean. We do welcome any queries, comments or questions that you may have of an astronomical nature. And you can email us at astronomy@dublincityfm.ie. We have a text and WhatsApp line, both being the same, which is quite handy, 087-179-1032. And I'd love to hear from you. So no doubt during the course of the programme, we'll hear from somebody. So there we go. Now, before we go into the Perseids, which were the highlight of the weekend, we'll quickly run through the planets, etc. And Mercury is at +0.4, so quite dim just at the moment. It's very low in the bright twilight. And it starts around 20 to 30 minutes after sunset. So if you want to use binoculars, you can look for it just above the horizon due west, just as it's sort of getting dark. If you find it, you can spot fainter Mars in the vicinity as well. It's quite difficult to see. Venus is, of course, is out of sight just at the moment. It's inferior conjunction with the Sun, so it's not where we want to be to see it. Mars faint at only 1.8. That's +0.8. It's the next brightest thing near Mercury in bright twilight. So you've got to use binoculars for this to look for it. 7 degrees above the left of Mercury and about 5 degrees by the 11th, 12th, 13th, ring around about now, and that's about as close as we're going to get. So good luck if you want to see if you can find Mars. They will appear back, of course, in our morning and evening skies as the year goes on. Jupiter, fine sight. The other night I was out watching it, as I was watching the Perseids as well, -2.5. It's in Aries, rising just before or around midnight, and you can watch for it to come up low in the east, northeast. By the beginning of dawn, it shines very high towards the southeast as well, so you can get a good view of that as well. Saturn, on the other hand, magnitude +0.5, so it's almost universal. It's very, very dim in Aquarius. It rises in twilight, and it's nearing its August 26th opposition, which means it's going to disappear after dark. Saturn glows in the brightest thing low, as the brightest thing low in the east southeast, it's highest in the south and sharpest and steadiest in a telescope around 1 or 2 a.m. in the morning if you're one of those early birds as well. And Uranus, 5.7 in Aries. It's nice, tie before dawn, around 9 degrees east of Jupiter. And Neptune, magnitude 7.8 in the Aquarius-Pisces border, rising around nightfall, and it's high in the south before dawn, about 20 degrees east of Saturn. Now, this was the weekend for the Perseid meteor shower. Hands up who who braved us and went outside just to see if they could spot a few. I went out on the 11th, which is Friday. Unfortunately, too cloudy where I was, so I didn't get to see many. So I did keep a watch during the course of the evening. I thought it was in for the same on Saturday night, the 12th, into Sunday, the 13th, up to about 10 to 3 in the morning. It was cloudy. Then it went crystal clear until about 20 to 4 for me where I am. And these, they're mesmerizing to watch these Perseid meteor shower streaking across the sky at regular intervals, 1 to 2 a minute you can get to see. Down lower, you don't get to see as many, but if you're looking straight up towards Cassiopeia, that's where they're coming in through, where Perseus is. And you can see probably up to 80 Perseids in an hour from less than perfect skies near Dublin, which we were. And you can rarely weighed. In fact, you get to see quite a lot of these, and some of them are huge, some of them are not so huge. They come from all different directions, so all you needed to do was look straight up into the sky. So I got a good view of probably 50, I would imagine 50 Perseid meteors coming through the skies between the 10 to 3 and 20 to 4 before it clouded over again. And I was just so lucky that I stuck my head out the window to see if it was going to clear up. Unfortunately, on Sunday, you know, there was still a good chance to see a few, but fortunately it was cloudy where I was. So with a bit of luck, somewhere around the country, around the world, you would have got to see some of the meteor shower, and maybe you've taken a load of photographs as well. So I suppose the next one we have to watch out for, which is the second best one, is the Geminids in December. And they're, the Perseids and the Geminids are by far the two best meteor showers of the year. So with the Perseids, you can see up to 120 in a really dark sky per hour. And the Geminids, you could probably see 60, 70, maybe 80 per hour as well. If you're in a really dark sky, and of course allow yourself about 20 minutes or so for your eyes to adjust to the dark light. So just a little bit of advice there as well. So of course, thrilling people, all the stargazers around the world, and I haven't had a chance to have a look at a lot of photographs because I'm still mesmerized by the bits and pieces that I saw, and it's certainly one of the best years that I had to watch the Perseid meteor shower this year. And of course we had the added advantage of a moonless sky as well. And I did get to see the moon rise at about 2:30, just, you know, just through the clouds. And it was only very thin, waning moon as well. So it was brilliant this year for that as well. Now, if you're a spot the station type of person, that's the International Space Station. That is Friday, August the 25th. For 5 minutes at 5:22 a.m. Now that's sort of just getting bright, but that's the next time we will see the International Space Station flying over Dublin. And Saturday as well, August the 26th at 4:36 a.m. for 3 minutes. The first one flying at 17 degrees above the horizon, and maximum height for the second night, 12 degrees. So they're both quite low, but well worth looking for, because one of my favourite pastimes is watching the International Space Station fly through our skies. And we have to wait for it really to come back into our evening skies from September the 14th until October the 3rd. So that's not that far away. We'll feel it, but it's not that far away indeed. Daylight, sunrise and sunset for Dublin tomorrow morning, 6:06 a.m. and setting at 20:51, which is 10 just before or just after 10 to 9 in the evening. And we're losing at the moment about 3 minutes and 50 seconds of daylight. And we're starting to feel it now. At about 8:30, 9 o'clock now, we're starting to get that dim area of the sky. Let's just say you can feel the winter coming this way. And moonrise, it's only a 1% moon just at the moment, so it was great, as I say, over the weekend. It's almost disappeared out of our skies, so we can't see it. Tomorrow morning, it will rise at 5:37 a.m. and it will set at 21:24. That's in the evening. Of course, you won't see it during the daylight because it's just too bright, and it's quite far away. In fact, it's the furthest away from us that it will get this particular time of the month. And at 406,634 kilometres away from us. Yeah, and it creeps back to 300, and I know where the supermoon time is, to about 350,000 kilometres, there or thereabouts, maybe a tiny bit, and that's where we get our supermoons, because it's a little bit closer as well. Now, anybody ever wondered how far we would have travelled in our lifetime? Well, we can sit here and do this. We are moving as we speak. We're not leaving the home or anywhere as well, if you're listening here. And I'll just give you an idea of what the speed we're doing. Now, I've done this before. This came up in the news this particular week. And if you were to stand in the North or South Pole, the geographic poles, you wouldn't actually travel anywhere. So you just go around in a circle. So you wouldn't be going that quickly. But those on the equator and creeping up, we'll get a tremendous amount of linear speed thanks to the rotation, roughly 1,000 miles per hour at the equator, where we are now probably 750 miles an hour. But most people don't live on the equator, however, so we can say that the average human is constantly travelling at around about 930 miles per hour, if you take a general view of it as well. So, as we will see, precision does not really matter here at all. When you add up that over the 80-year lifespan, that's the 70 years and 10 plus 10 again, each person travels about 1 billion kilometres in their lifetime, clocking up around this 1,000 miles per hour as well. So that's a tremendous leap above the travel we do on the Earth's surface, of course, but we're just getting warmed up. In addition to rotating, Earth orbits the Sun around 70,000 miles per hour. That orbit is in a slight eclipse, which causes our planet to occasionally move more quickly or slowly depending on the distance from the Sun. But on average, Earth's orbital speed is about 19 miles per second. So that's from, doesn't bear thinking, it's remarkable. Imagine being able to see 19 miles per second. So, we have 600 million miles, or 1 billion kilometres every year, so over a lifetime each of us travels roughly 50 billion miles. And this again dwarfs the distance we travel due solely to the rotation of the planet. But Earth, as we're in it, is not the only object in motion in the universe. The Sun travels in a long, lazy orbit around the centre of the Milky Way galaxy. One of these galaxy years takes about 230 million years to complete. We're not going to see that one. To put it into perspective, life first arose on Earth around 17 galactic years ago. And that's in only 25 more galactic years, the Sun will die. So, unfortunately, we're a bit gloomy there as well. So, to put it in a nutshell, we're travelling about 575,000 miles per hour because we're going up with the universe, we're going out with the universe, we're going round in a circle around the Sun, and of course the Earth is going around at 1,000 miles per hour. So just bear that in mind. If we were to hit anything, we would just fly off. It's really remarkable. Just a few pointers about the Perseid meteor shower, just to let you know, not a lot of people know this, but on July the 16th, 1862, the comet was independently discovered by Lewis Swift and by Horace Parnell Tuttle on July the 19th, both independently in the same year, 1862, and that was just to prove that the comet was around. And it's got an orbital period of about 133 years, so we're not going to see that in our lifetime, although it did appear in 1992. That was the most recent appearance, but it was a good bit away. It was about 1 billion kilometres, or just a little bit more. And it's one of those things that we fly through every year and just catch the little grains of sand or the dirty grains of whatever it is, ice and all that sort of things, which flake through our skies. So just to cap it up again, they come in from the area of Perseus, which is the Perseids, which is almost straight up, at after midnight, and it's one of those things that if you can find the W of Cassiopeia, that's roughly where they come in from. Now, they will come in from different angles and different areas as well, but some of you get a rogue one here and there coming from the other end, but it doesn't. So, 133 years, it came in back in December the 11th, 1992, I think I remember that actually. And it has a radius of 13 kilometres, so it's not that big of a comet, but it's spawned it and certainly created a lot of interest over the years for us here on Earth as we flake through the tail of all the different, like the Halley Comet, things like that as well. So, anyway, you're listening to the Astronomy Show right here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. John Dixon here. Of course, Ben is away this week, and he's very funny enough, he's away next week as well, so I'll be here with you this time next week as well. And if you want to send us a text, it's 087-179-1032. The other question is Comet Swift-Tuttle on a collision course with Earth? No. Not for the next unforeseeable future anyway, so it won't concern us whatsoever. Now, let's meet some of the SpaceX Crew 7 astronauts launching to the ISS on August the 25th. We have Jasmine Mogbele, we have Andreas Mogensen, And they're of the European Space Agency, ESA, Japan's Satoshi Furukawa, and Russian cosmonaut Konstantin Borisov. And there are another couple as well there of slightly lesser well, giving it a chance to go up into the skies. So watch out for that particular launch on the 25th, which is in about 10 days' time. We're all going well, and we'll just keep an eye on that as well. Virgin Galactic, we mentioned last week that they were going to bring their first tourist passengers into space. They did this, and they launched their first tourist passengers into the weightlessness of space last Thursday. And the culmination of nearly two decades of commercial pursuit, the company said, the three passengers who were, John Goodwin, Keisha Shashaf, and her teenage daughter Anastasia Myers, they floated gravity-free through the Virgin spacecraft about 45 minutes after takeoff. That must have been some experience. And they were about 50 miles, which is just about into space as well, so they could feel the effects of weightlessness with the lack of gravity. So this is the dream of space tourism for Virgin Galactic. And after a few minutes in space, the craft began descending and safely landed in the U.S. state of New Mexico on the same runway from which it took off. And technology brilliant nowadays. So this particular mission was named Galactic 02. And it's the company's second commercial flight. And I believe that the ladies who were on this won the tickets. But if you go back into 2004 when it was started, Virgin Galactic has sold around 800 tickets for seats on future spacecraft, 600 between 2005 and 2014 for $200,000 each, plus probably fuel surcharges and all that sort of stuff. And now if you want to get a little run up there. There was 200 tickets sold for about $450,000 each, and Goodwin reserved his seat in 2005, only to be struck with a little bit of Parkinson's 9 years later, dampening his hopes. So he thought it was going to be the end, but it wasn't. So good news there. So the Shafaf and Myers won their tickets in a charity raffle organized by Virgin Galactic. That was some prize, and imagine winning that. So it would have been absolutely fantastic. Now, we watched the Parker Solar Probe take off a number of years ago, and it's about to make its closest flyby of Venus on August the 21st. And since 2021, the Parker Solar Probe has been treading impressively close to the Sun in order to capture unprecedented data about our home star. In fact, the record-breaking spacecraft completed its closest approach yet to the blazing ball of plasma, which is the Sun, coming within 5.3 million miles, or 8.3 million kilometers, of the solar surface to reach these incredible milestones. So that's its job, to check bits and pieces on the Sun to see how it works. And Parker gets by with a little help from its friends, and one of these being Venus. So Parker is on track to make its sixth and closest flyby of Venus on August the 21st, thanks to some precise manoeuvring that took place on August the 3rd. And these are all these little things in the background that they do that we would never ever see, and which keeps it back on track. So it's adjusting its trajectory by about 77 miles and increasing its speed by 1.4 seconds while heading to Venus. And I suppose these shifts are quite minute, considering the probe has been travelling at hundreds of thousand miles per hour while flying through the inner solar system. But it's remarkably well. And of course, our Earth, as we know, sits 93 million miles away from that shining yellow orb that we call the Sun, which is getting quite active just at the moment. It's been knocking out telecommunications and all sorts of things as well. So it's brilliant to watch that. So you can Google that quite easily, actually. Just put in the NASA Parker Solar Probe. You can catch that very, very quickly indeed. Now, let's go to the other side. From, instead of being in rockets, 1,600 people have signed and paid a space prospector for a balloon ride to the edge of space. So 50 years ago, the space race pitted superpowers against each other, of course, in the scramble to be first to reach Earth's nearest celestial neighbour. And enterprise, the private enterprise that is, dominates the 21st century so far at the moment, as space tourism companies, and they pit their technologies against each other to sell seats, and the wealthy thrill seekers vie for limited space. So recently, Space Perspective announced it had sold more than 1,600 tickets, and they raised about 200 million in sales, and they go up in a big balloon. And the spaceship Neptune, as it's called, is a capsule offering 360-degree panoramic views, equipped with a loo and 9 recliners. They are luxury in space, 8 for paying space customers, and 1 for a captain. Of course, that's very important to have somebody driving the balloon, whoever they manage that. So, according to the website, spaceship Neptune will come equipped with a bar and Wi-Fi service, presenting what the company describes with as a luxurious lounging experience during an excursion into space, which more closely resembles a hot air balloon ride with more than a rocket launch. And the cost for Space Perspective 6-hour journey, hence they need the loo, is $160,000, which is not, which is much the same as our own here, about €150,000. And we know that looking down on Earth from space will radically shift one's perception, which would be a fantastic thing to do, of our world and the place within it, and which is why we designed the spaceflight experience that is as gentle on our planet as it is on our explosers. So, what is space tourism? That's the big burning question at the moment. It's the human space travel for recreational purposes. Space Perspective, Space Adventures, Blue Origin, Virgin Galactic, and Space X all cater to send clients into sub-orbit and low Earth orbit as well. And the Virginia-based Space Adventures and Space X are the only two companies taking clients to Earth orbit just at the moment. Of course, if you remember last year, William Shatner, although he's been there before, Warp 7 in the Starship Enterprise, or maybe it was just a gimmick altogether. Now, just something I caught just earlier on, and it's to do with Mars at the moment, and saying that now Mars had a wet, dry climate conducive to supporting life. And the Curiosity rover has discovered the first evidence that Mars once had a climate which altered between wet and dry seasons. It was hard to believe this so many years ago, and they had wet and dry seasons similar here to Earth. And this was a study just released on Wednesday, suggesting that the red planet may have once had the right conditions to support life. And though the surface of Mars is now an arid desert, billions of years ago rivers, and there is evidence if you see the photographs of the surface, and vast lakes are thought to have stretched across its surface. And since 2012, the Curiosity rover has been exploring the huge Gale crater. It's been there for a while now at this stage, which is believed to be home of a former lake and has a massive mountain of sediment nearly 6 kilometres high in its centre. So that's hard to believe. And they quickly realized that they were working with lakes and rivers deposits and all sorts of things, but did not know what type of climate they were linked to. So this is the ongoing saga, or the running forward. And they describe it as being pretty lucky to have seen with the cameras that are up there on the orbiters and on the rovers as well. So, of course, when lakes dry up, we often see cracks, mud cracks, and we fill back up, the cracks heal. And this is what happens. So repeat this process enough time and the cracks arrange themselves in hexagons. So there we go. And I've just texted the text line as well. And Alan, good evening to you. He saw a Perseid meter flash across the plough, which was an interesting one as well. That's over a little bit further to the left. The Cassiopeia areas, if you go from the plough through the North Pole Star and out the same distance again, Cassiopeia. So it was a clear starry sky in Kildare last night, which is great to see. Unfortunately, we didn't have that up here. And it's brilliant to see that people are listening and they've been out spotting or trying to spot all these little meteors flaking through the sky. And we're just course, listening to the Astronomy Show right here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Today being the 15th of August, 2023. And just a reminder that the Perseids will still be around until the 24th. You will get to see not as many as we did over the weekend, but you will get to see an odd few still sneaking into our skies, and a few of the rogue ones as well. So there we go. Now, just during the week, we had Russian cosmonauts perform their spacewalk to attach a debris shield or shields to the space station. And the two Russian cosmonauts involved conducted a spacewalk just on Wednesday to upgrade systems on the ISS before they set out on the spacewalk. The Sergei Prokofiev and Dmitry Petelin, they'll venture out into the station's Poisk airlock to attach three debris shields to the RASFET module. Now, space debris is one of the big things. It's a bit of a problem just over the years, because there's such an amount of space junk and bits and pieces of rockets flying around, some of them crashing into each other, adding more to it as well. Each time the Starlinks go up, that's more, and a lot of this stuff does come back down to Earth and just burn up as well. But, you know, this is just the way it is, so they have to try and protect themselves as much as they possibly can to eliminate the possibility of getting injured while out on a space walk, or even the danger of a light and small meter, or even a bigger one, going through the hull of the space station itself. Now, chemical contamination on the ISS is out of this world, is the headline across I picked up in the last day or so as well. And concentrations of potentially harmful chemical compounds in dust collected from air filtration systems on the ISS exceed those found in floor dust for many American homes, is what they're saying as well. So even on the outside, they're saying that the surface of the International Space Station is grubby, wherever the dust and stuff came from, we just don't know. So the results have been published in the Environmental, Space and Technology Letters, so we can look that one up as well. And they're trying to, I don't know if they're bringing small hoovers up to see if they can bring stuff back down again, but contaminants found in the space duct included polybrominated diphenyl ethers, PBDEs, and I haven't heard that one before, and all sorts of other weird things as well. And it's a concern up there. Each time they go up, they bring a few organic pollutants and things like that as well. So it's not the greatest thing. And, of course, the air inside the ISS is constantly recirculated with about 8 to 10 changes per hour, similar to an aircraft, while CO2 and gaseous trace contaminant removal occurs. So it's well filtered as well. And the degree to this remove chemicals like the BFRs is unknown. So it's another thing that they are looking into at the moment. And they inspect these in the International Space Station vacuum bags comprising from previous airborne particles. They bring them back down to Earth. They come from clothing lint, hair, and other debris generally identified as spacecraft cabin dust. And some of these bags come back to Earth for analysis and things like that, to see exactly if there is going to be a particular problem as well. So there we go. Anyway, that's about it from me for this evening. Thank you indeed for listening. And that email address for comments and questions is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie. Ben is not back until 2 weeks' time, so I'll be back next with you as well. And thanks as ever to James Sweeney for making the show available as a podcast, and indeed to Conor Lennon for making it available on astronomy.ie. And I know we have some listeners down in Spain who are just having a little bit of trouble getting the podcast. Now, unfortunately, it's a little bit over myself and Ben's head, but we are trying to rectify that as well. So that's all from me, John Dixon, for this particular edition of the Astronomy Show here in 103.2 Dublin City FM. Next, Hello China, 9 p.m. with Threads with Bren Linnett. At 11 p.m. we veer to the Globe with Nigel Wood. That's worth listening to. Good fun. I do it quite often as well. And then midnight, After Hours with Dave Barry, where he plays jazz, blues and soul until 2 a.m. So please join myself same time next week, and I'll be back with the latest news from around the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thanks for listening. Say goodnight, John. Good night, John. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.